It's our pleasure to have here remotely today Mark, which who is a postdoc at the University of Geneva, and he will be talking about matrix NFTs.
Yeah, thank you very much, and yeah, thank you to Daniel for the opportunity to give this talk, despite the technical difficulties that I had. Okay, what I'm going to talk about is about this idea that the general principles of unitarity and analyticity, sometimes they give you much more than you were expecting. I will present these two examples that these two assumptions give you a new way to compute anomalous dimension for this matrix, which is something that, I will try to convince you that is relevant for phenomenological studies. And also I will show you, if I have enough time, that they also constrain much more than you were expecting the space of possible effective field theories you can have in the IR. So yeah, I will have these two a bit of separate topics. Yeah, the connection is this idea, but they are a little bit disconnected. So, let me try to see if I can make it for both. So, before starting, let me put everything into some kind of philosophical framework. If you look at the last century of particle physics with the knowledge that we have now, it looks like particle physics has been on rails, because at the moment you see a muon decay, you know that there is a W. You have a W, you scatter it, you see that breaks unitarity, so you need something new, something like the Higgs. The Higgs has many problems that you all know. If you are a little bit smart, you might say, maybe there is some symmetry, like supersymmetry, so you split the spectrum, and not only now the Higgs is stable, but you have, you have all these benefits. Now you have dark matter, unification, and so on. So to me, it's still a shock that this didn't happen. So particle physics is now completely different to what it was 10 years ago, and is back to its origin. It's pure exploration of the unknown. So the philosophy a little bit that I will take now is that you have this dynamics that is explained by the standard model, but this dynamics is nothing else than some infrared manifestation of some UV theory. And you have no idea what this UV theory is, but what has to happen for sure is that at some point the standard model will start to shake, because you will see these deformations that are induced by the heavy dynamics. And these deformations are going to tell you in which way the standard model is deformed. No, as we were saying before, there is still room for the high Lumi LHC, but the big things we expect that they are going to come for the next collider. So while we are waiting for it, maybe we might get some hints from precision experiments and from flavor this mu 3 that I will tell you later about these mu 3 conversions, and maybe about EDM. So since I did something about EDM, let me focus just a minute on the electric dipole moments. So the electron EDM is a coupling that breaks CP. So there were one experiment in Berkeley that looked for it 20 years ago, put some constraints, and then nothing happened until a few years ago, where this ACME collaboration in Harvard and Yale, they managed to improve the constraints by an order of magnitude, and a few years later they improved the constraints by another order of magnitude. So now the constraints are in this 10 to the minus 29 e times centimeter. So you see that the dipole is a length scale, so this is measured in centimeters. So and this length scale is basically 20 orders of magnitude smaller than the Compton wavelength of the electron. So this is in precision what translates to in the language of particle physics is that there is a very high scale, energy scale associated with some possible dynamics that might induce this dipole moment. And in fact, if you do some stupid counting and you say that this electron in the end is suppressed by two loops, and also by an electron mass or a chirality flip, you get that these dynamics that might generate an electron in medium are above 3 TeV's, no? So you are putting relevant constraints, I mean, relevant in the sense that they are beyond what the LHC is doing. So they are putting relevant constraints even at two loops. So you might want to characterize all the effects that go into this dipole, even if they are suppressed by two loops, even if you have to pay a chirality flip. But you ask something in your favor. You ask them to have a log enhancement. And this log enhancement comes from a log of lambda over the electroweak scale. And since lambda can be very high, this log is like a counting parameter, no? And this log enhancement is what tells you that what you have to do is to look at the RGS, because the RGS, is the content of these logs. So yeah, looking at the RGS will tell you which operators are relevant for this study. So for instance, what you can do is, I hope you can see the mouse. So you have here the dipole operators, and they can receive, so here there are a bunch of operators with a bunch of names. If you don't know what they are, you don't have to care about it. It's just the idea of what I'm trying to do. So you have these operators that are the dipoles, and you have some operators that enter at one loop, so they are suppressed only by one loop and enhanced by a log. Then there are another class of operators that enter in two loops, but they have a log square, because what they do is first they renormalize these operators, but then these ones go to the dipole. So this is a two-loop effect, so this is a two-loop contribution, but it's really a one-loop computation. You don't need to compute anything at two loops to have this two-loop effect, because it's one loop square. What is a real two-loop effect is the renormalization of these operators, whatever they are, into the dipole. So, yeah, this is what you want to do. No, it's not enough to compute the RGS at one loop. Maybe you also need to compute it at two loops. But once you have done this, you have that. This measurement of the electron EDM puts constraints, puts very strong constraints to any CP violating dynamics that goes into a dipole. So yeah, the numbers are what they are. So in the future it will get better. I will not stop into this, but in the future, probably in the near future, we will have several experiments with another order of magnitude increase. This might be a place you want to bet that something might come up, if you ask me. The electron medium is not the only place where these two-loop computations can play a role. Also, there is going to be, also in the near future, very big improvements in these muon to electron conversions. So muon to electron conversion can happen in three different ways. It can be mu to e gamma, which is similar to b to s gamma. It can be mu to e and also two electrons, so muon to three electrons. And it can also, you can also have a muon going to an electron in the presence of nuclei. And at the end of the day, these three experiments, what are doing from the EFT perspective is probing three different operators. Is the flavor violating dipole, the four fermion with electrons and quarks, and the fourth fermion with only leptons. And, okay, if you do the same power counting, you see that you also place constraints above something like 10 TeV, even if this contribution is two-loop suppressed. So you see again another set of experiments that where two-loop contributions might be important, two-loop RCEs. So what I'm going to tell you now is a way to compute these anomalous dimensions, because if you do it by hand, it's super painful. So there is this other way to these computations, and it's what we did with John Elias and James in this paper. So the idea is a little bit the following. You have considered the form factor. The form factor is nothing else as the basically the response of a given state once you insert one operator. For instance, you insert whatever operator, and for instance, this form factor might take the form of S plus T, I mean, some kinematical dependence. And this kinematical dependence can be polynomial if this interaction is a contact interaction, no? If there are no poles, nothing propagating. Now, these form factors can, of course, receive loop contributions. And this is what give you logs, and this is what you associate with anomalous dimensions. So if you pick the logs of these form factors, you are going to pick the anomalous dimensions of some operators. In this case, in this picture, you will see the anomalous dimension of the operator J going into the operator I. Now, the thing is that the form factor has several properties. The first one is that in perturbation theory, and maybe even beyond, but this is not proven, a form factor, and also we don't care for now, also a form factor is related across both sides of the cap, because there is a cap for a positive S, this condition. So yeah, basically the F of S is F star of S star, basically. And so this, you can think of it as a rotation in the complex plane, and this rotation is generated by the dilatation operator, right? And so, okay, you keep this in mind. And on the other hand, unitarity implies the following. So you have this one factor, no? And now you insert the identity, so you put the sum of these intermediate states, these beta states. And now here you identify this this term as the S matrix, because it's the overlap between the in and out states, no? And then this term here is the form factor, but for the in states, but with CPT is F star, the F star that appeared before. So now you see that you have a way to relate F star in this way, and you see that CPT, unitarity, and analyticity, which is the three assumptions that we put here, give you this equation. If you remember something about Weinberg or 2D quantum theory, this is a generalization of the Poisson equation, but just a name. Okay, this is something that was derived in a slightly different way by Karen Huot and Wilhelm a few years ago. Okay, what you can do with this equation is the following. So in the left-hand side, this is just the S matrix. So you have the S matrix times the fourth factor gives you basically the convolution of the S matrix with the operator associated to the form factor. And on the left hand side, you associate the dilatation operator to the anomalous dimensions in this way by the current semantic equation. Okay, the question is this: at leading order, you can forget about the beta function, so you have this. And for the purpose of this talk, I will focus on terms where the and infrared divergences, or the anomalous, so yeah, gamma IR at zero. So only gamma UB is non-zero. So you end up with this equation that says the following. So the numbers dimension of the operator I going to the operator, so the operator J going to the operator I takes this form. So it's the convolution of the matrix element with the operator J divided by the form factor of the operator I. If this is a bit cryptic, don't worry, because I'll show you what it means.
Sorry. So, can we go back a bit? So what's alpha there? I got lost a bit with the notation. What's alpha?
Yeah, sorry. The notation is probably just a little bit crap. It's a state. It's a generic state. It's like P1, P2, P3, P4.
Okay. And where
is it's some state.
Okay, and where did unitarity enter in that like line that you have there, F, blah, blah, blah? It just enters via, yeah, where?
Yeah, unitarity enters in this sum that, okay, yeah, sorry, it's a bit schematic. This sum is like an integral when you integrate over all these betas. These betas are basically intermediate states.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, this will be an integral over the phase space because these betas will be are going to be a two-particle states. So you want to integrate over all of them.
I see.
So unitarity enters into here in saying that this is the identity.
Okay.
Okay. No, thank you, because yeah, the notation is a bit, yeah, so.
Sorry, I don't think I followed that. So you said that you had a set of complete states, I get that. But the unitarity, you're using the unitarity of S, right? So where does that come in? S is the first factor there, right? The alpha beta factor.
Yeah, S is the S matrix, which is the overlap between in and out states.
Right.
Right? And unitarity enters when I insert this sum over the betas. Over the state.
So my understanding is the sum of the betas, that's just a statement that those are a complete set of states, right? Whereas unitarity, yes, would be a statement about the overlap between beta and alpha. So where are you using that, I guess, is the question. The unitarity of it.
What you say is a statement about the overlap of beta and alpha?
The S matrix is the overlap between alpha and beta, right? That is the S matrix. And then yes, unitarity, yes, is a statement that that's a unitary matrix. And I'm not sure where you're using the fact that that's a unitary matrix.
Well, probably one thing implies to the other, no? Because if I have S dagger S, so in between, I'm basically integrating out over these betas, no? And I end up with the sandwich of alpha alpha, which is one. So probably one statement is equivalent to the other.
I'm just asking like a stupid algebra question. So if I'm just, how do I get from the left-hand side of the equation to the right-hand side of the equation? I see that I put a complete set of states in, and I'm good there. And then I gather that, yeah, the CPT statement is you're going to take the matrix element and you're going to do a CPT transformation on it. That'll give you a complex conjugate. And I where did you use unitarity?
Yeah, unitarity is in this, in the other equality. It's by... No, is when you insert this sum over betas.
Why isn't that just a statement that the betas are a complete set?
Yeah, which is saying that it's unitarity, you know, that you are considering basically all the states.
No, unitarity is a statement that if I sum over all mutually exclusive things, then the, you know, the probabilities all sum to one as a function of time, right? Whereas the statement that the betas are a complete set at a given time is just a statement about that time. And so
S dagger S equals to one, I think. So if by unitarity you mean that S dagger S equals to one, I think is equivalent to saying that you are considering a complete set of states.
What?
No?
I mean, that's, I would say that it's a, if it was not complete, it's not a basis. But that's just, you're talking about what your basis is. It seems like that has nothing to do with unitarity.
I mean,
I don't want to derail you here. It's just that,
No, I understand that this, it's about how you call things. But I think one thing implies the other.
I don't think so.
Okay.
At least if I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, maybe you're right. And
but maybe I can ask you about it later on. Is it crucial for the rest of the talk that the message I'm getting is that you have a relationship which is coming because you say it follows from CBT unitarity and analyticity and nothing else. Yeah. And that's the main message, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, CBT is clear, no? This is this is related to FSTAR by CBT. Okay, at least in my language, unitarity is exactly this, that you have a complete set of states.
And so maybe a different question is in the equation which is in a box, what role is dilatations are kind of showing up, and where did that come from? Because that sounds like that's different from CBT unitarity and analyticity. And that's what you're using to get your anomalous dimensions from, right?
Yeah. Well, it's coming from the. It's coming by doing. So, you have this reality condition, no?
Okay.
And you're saying that that you're getting this minus I epsilon by going through the. I mean, by doing the rotation of the momenta. And this rotation of the momenta. No, and this rotation of the momenta is done by this operator, and you identify this with the dilatation operator.
Okay.
Okay. So, yeah, if you take this relation, the only non-trivial part is this convolution between the matrix element and the operator. And probably this will clarify a bit with the notation. So I'm writing this this object here in a diamagmatic way. So this matrix element is, for instance, is here is okay. It's what it is. It's the matrix element between four scalars. This part here is the form factor associated with this operator, which is basically unit this operator. I mean, the form factor for this operator is only non-vanishing when you contain four states. So you have two gauge boson and two scalars, and the convolution is basically this sum that I was writing before is really an integral. You basically integrate over all the states, or what is equivalent here, you integrate over all momenta. So if the claim is that if you compute this object here, you're going to get the subreal normalization of this operator. And now you basically plug in the thing, so the matrix element takes this form, the form factor takes this form, this angle brackets 3-4 is lambda, so I will just tell you in a second in the next slide. And this integral here is the phase space integral, I will also tell you before. And what you get is indeed the anomalous dimension of this operator. You can check in the literature. So
there lambda is the coefficient in front of what?
Yeah, lambda is the coefficient of, it comes from this matrix element, so it's the contact interaction
of the Higgs. Okay, it's the Higgs quartic.
Yeah, it's the Higgs quartic, yes.
Okay, so I see.
What about NS? Sorry, I got sort of lost about that.
What is?
NS?
NS, sorry, is the number of the scalar, so... Yeah, in the standard model you have complex scalars. You have two because it's a doublet. You're basically, you see that the contractions of flavor sum over all the intermediate states. So you have NS. NS plus one.
So then, sorry, go ahead, Davide. Okay, so basically on the second line of this slide, M is always a matrix element of another operator, and the operator on the right is the one that you're trying to renormalize.
Yeah, exactly. Depending on the matrix element that you consider, you will get one renormalization of or another. Yeah, exactly. Form factor is kind of fixed if you want, but the matrix element can change.
I see.
And is this there... is what will give you a different renormalization to different operators. Yeah.
And is this? You're probably just giving us a kind of a sketch of it, but is there a reason why this particular operator doesn't mix with other operators, or is it?
Exactly. It's what Daniel was saying is that, I mean, now we put, just to see an example, now we put this matrix element, but you can put the matrix element of two Higgses going instead of two scalars to two fermions. Or two gauge bosons, and then you will have another type of anomalous dimension.
And you kind of build up the matrix of the anomalous dimension matrix by doing all possible choices of M and all possible choices of O. I guess is that what happened?
Yeah, exactly.
And you build M only out of the renormalizable interactions.
Because I'm interested only when I have only one insertion of dimension six operators. So the dimension six operators only enter on the form factor, right?
Yeah.
Of course, you can consider dimension six operators on the part of the matrix element, but this will give you anomalous dimensions that have an extra insertion of dimension six. And probably you're renormalizing dimension 8, not dimension 6. So, yeah, I'm considering insertions in the form factor.
And is this easier than just straight up calculating the anomalous dimension the way that people did it, you know, like Anhart and company did?
Yeah, this is what I will show you at the end, the comparison between the two methods.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, for this example, it's already trivial with, trivial. It's easy with the Feynman diagram. So, but no, in some cases you might get, especially when you go to two loops, you get, this is much easier. I will show you.
Thank you.
Okay, so before showing you, let me just tell you what is this angle bracket 3-4 and this integral here. So this angle bracket 3-4 that comes from the, from the form factor of this operator is just lambdas. Is this Spinor notation. What the Spinor notation is at the end of the day is just write everything, moment and polarization vectors in terms of Spinor. So you homogenize a little bit the way you write down your amplitudes. And the good thing of doing this is that the Spinors tell you something about the lissity. They carry this little group weight, so they tell you if you're considering plus or minus lissity fermions or vectors. And for example, this operator here, so two fermions and two scalars with one derivative in the middle. If you want, the Feynman rule is this thing, but now you can put the momentum you can write the momentum in terms of a speed. And you get this this expression here, and the difference between the two expressions is because you consider different helicity for the fermions, and the fact that there is a minus here and a plus here is a typo. Sorry, but okay. And also the phase space integral, you have to integrate the momenta. But there is a way. But now you wrote the moment in terms of a spin-off. But there is a way to. There is a way to do it. That was, For instance, it's this thing. This is a technical thing. You can do the phase space integrals in this way. Is at the end you have integrals over a trigonometric function. The second example I wanted to give is how four fermions renormalize each other, but let me just skip it. because this is another example of what you do. You put the form factor in one side, the matrix element in the other. You integrate the intermediate state, and you get the anomalous dimensions, which is the thing you have below. One thing that I wanted to show before going to the two-loop computations is this non-renormalization theorems, because I think this was this has been relatively important in this this topic, because there were some works. There was this paper by Manohar that they computed the full one-loop anomalous dimensions of dimension six operators, and they were realizing that most of the entries have zeros that were seemingly purely accidental, because they were computing the diagram and suddenly it cancels one contribution to the other and you get a zero. And it was not clear where this was coming from. And this was solved in some way in this series of papers by Manohar, this group in Barcelona, also Cheung. Also this paper by Bern very recently also commented on these things and extended it a little bit. The reason I bring this thing up is because this language makes these theorems basically trivial. You will see. Because the Spinner language splits the dimension six operators in basically five broad categories. The first one is when you have, so you list all the operators and you look at the form factors. For instance, this one with three gauge fields, field strength, the form factor is basically a polynomial of just by helicity and dimension analysis. It's a polynomial of six lambdas, or if you want, three angle brackets. Then you have another class of operators that give you two angle brackets. The Yukawas give you only the part on the fermions that give you some helicity structure, so you have one set of angle brackets. H26 give you nothing. And then there are a bunch of operators that give you angle brackets times square brackets. So having in mind this classification simplifies a little bit the reasoning of these non-renormalization theorems. And you have to basically to keep in mind two things. First one is that, remember what you did, no? So you have one operator with, you have one form factor associated with one operator with so many legs, whatever. What you do to renormalize another operator, at least at one loop, is that you take two legs of this operator, you integrate them, you have to integrate them in the space, and the matrix element is at least 2-2-2. So 2-1 is zero. At least you have 2-2-2 or 2-2n in general. So, and the form factor that you're going to get has the number of legs equal to the number of legs of this little diagram that, you can imagine. So you see, the least thing you can do is to eliminate two legs and create two more. So you can never go down in the number of legs. So this explains why F cube can renormalize the other operators, but phi six or the Yukawas cannot renormalize the operators with a fewer number of legs. Okay.
Excuse me, one question.
Yeah.
Are you considering massless particles, or why are you using a massless Spinor helicity variable? Or not?
Yes, thank you. I should have said this. You don't care much, actually, because since you're computing anomalous dimensions, the mass doesn't appear anywhere. So when you're computing anomalous dimensions, you are at scale mu. Everything above is integrated out, and everything below is massless. So, people were doing these computations in the symmetric phase of the standard model because, you can treat everything as massless, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I haven't.
Actually, is that statement? Is that statement true to some fixed order? It sounds like it's like if I were looking at the, you know, instead of anomalous dimensions, if I'd been looking at the running of couplings or something, then I know that to the first few orders, everything is scheme independent. But if I kind of work my way down the loop expansion, eventually things will depend on exactly how, if I use a mass independent scheme or a mass dependent scheme. Is it, are you relying on that?
No, because if you want, the anomalous dimension is a number, so you cannot have a kinematical dependence in this thing. So this would be important when, if you want to renormalize dimension 6 from dimension 8 operators. So, because here we are considering, at the end we are considering two loops. So you might wonder if dimension 8 operators, renormalizing dimension 6 operators at one loop, can have a comparable effect to these two loop computations. The answer is, of course, yes, depending on where you go in the parameter space. But you see, you have to go down. So now you have to insert powers of the mass or basically the BEF. In the standard model, all the mass is controlled by the Higgs BEF. So, yeah. In that case, you will have dependence on the masses. But if you stay at dimension 6 or at dimension 4 or whatever,
I guess. So this probably doesn't matter in practice, but if I just try and translate what you said into, let's say I didn't have higher dimensions at all, I just worked in the renormalizable part of the theory. So I'm just looking at runnings of couplings or something. Then it's true that it's a very scheme dependent thing, right? I can set things up where the running of the couplings depends on the masses or not. And it's a little bit up to me how I define things. So I'm just kind of wondering if there's a similar choice going on in the way you're setting things up here as well.
Okay, you say that...
I mean, normally we don't look at mass dependent schemes because those are a lot harder, right? So we normally choose to look at mass independent schemes, which maybe you're doing too, but I don't.
Yeah, I mean, here you're doing the MS bar scheme.
So that's a mass independent scheme. Okay.
Yeah. So. Yeah, maybe you're right that if you look at two loops, I mean, not the two loops, I mean, the two loops I'm going to show you are fine, but some two loop computations might start to have a dependence. Maybe. But you see, I think that you should have this dependence on the loops in the matrix element. And these are contributions that we have not taken into account. So, I mean,
I can believe in MS bar. I can believe in MS bar. It's not going to. It won't come up. It's that's probably the answer.
You can right make there. It maybe show up in. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. But at one loop, at the order. At one loop, this thing will never show up. Because at the end of the day, you see here you don't see the loop. You have something at tree level, and a phase space integration. It will show up when you have the form factor at tree level and the matrix element at one loop, and you are computing something at two loops that has this this form. Now you have to do a real one loop computation in the matrix element, and this issue might show up. I mean, of course, you can always go to the MS bar scheme, but...
I guess, so that's really my, I guess that's my question is in this calculation, the way you're doing it all in terms of S matrix, and you're using kind of the unitarity of that cut in that graph of it, as I understand it, right? And so it's like you're avoiding talking about off-shell things. And I'm wondering where is it, where do I make the choices that I would have made in a kind of a more standard MS bar running calculation, those same choices must be hidden in your calculation somewhere. I'm just wondering where they are.
Yeah, that's why I was putting the example of going to two loops, because there I have, as you say, I have off-shell things. But here everything is Yeah, you say it's purely on shell.
Yeah.
So
I can ask you that later on anyway. It's not,
Okay. Okay, so yeah, you learn, yeah, you see this thing that you cannot go down in the number of legs. So yeah, you cannot transition into the left in this diagram. But there is a second effect that you have to take into account when looking in the normalization between for particle operators. And it's that to go from this class of operators, the angle bracket square operators, to the lower class, the angle bracket square bracket, you have to change the elasticity of your form factors, no? So you need that the four particle amplitude that you put in the S matrix by the elasticity. And if you look at the standard model, there is only one such amplitude, that is the amplitude between four Fermion operators between up and down quarks. It's the only amplitude that that modifies the, I mean, that has a net elasticity. And in fact, it's the only transition that you have at one loop. All the others are forbidden because of these elasticity selection rules. So basically, these two simple considerations explain all these one loop results and non-renormalization theorems and so on. They explain basically all the zero entries. So what happens at loops? Now at loops you can go down because now in the phase space you not only can put two particles, but you can put three particles, right? And now you can decrease by one the number of legs. So you can go from the Yukawa, for instance, to the dipole, which, if you remember, is the example I showed you with, I mean, when I was talking about the electron EVM. And these particular transitions are very simple to compute in with this method, because what you have is, again, everything is at tree level, and the only you have to do is to do a three-particle integration. But everything is, tree level and on shell. So let me just show you an example that is exactly this thing, is a Yukawa going to the dipole. And you have two types of diagrams. So in the right, you have the form factor associated with the Yukawa, no? So two Fermions and these three scalars. And then in the left-hand side, you have an S matrix, now a 3-2 S matrix, that has the particles and the final state such that at the end you have a dipole operator. So you see at the end, outside, you have, after you have integrated out everything, you have two fermions, a scalar and a photon. This is a dipole. So you have two types of diagrams. You have two ways to arrange this computation. This part is zero, so let me forget about it. So focus on these things. Now, the difficulty of this method is to write down the amplitude in a simple way, so it's compact and you can integrate it. And, okay, this amplitude, you can bring it to this form, where, this is just the kinematic independence. And there are two terms, the one proportional to the fermions and the one, so one fermion charge and two scalar charges, and the other matrix element is two fermion charges and one scalar charge. So the one that so this term here is zero because the integral measure is invariant under a change in 3 and 4, and this integrand is odd, so this is going to be zero, and you're left with this term here. And now the only thing you have to do is to take the particles here, the particles that cross the cut, integrate them out, and that's it. So the integral takes this form. You end up with some polynomial in lambdas that you can identify with the form factor of the dipole, and some number here that is some trigonometric integral that, I mean, by chance gives you one. Now, if on top of this you put the flavor structure of the standard model, you get the result that we computed in the paper on the EVM. So I was showing you this this computation because, I mean, since, I don't know, I did the two computations in the two methods, I can compare. So, yeah, you might get an idea. So, yeah, with Feynman diagrams, it was a total mess because maybe I'm also not a total mess. But in this method, I just show you basically how it's done from start to finish. So you can see that, yeah, it's much, much more efficient to do it in this way. At least this kind of computations where everything is three-level, and a phase space integration. And this structure is common in all the transitions that decrease the number of legs, because it's the only thing you have at the end. So there is another good thing about this method, and is that you can, it's green in the sense that you can recycle over and over the amplitudes. So for instance, this amplitude of two fermions, one scalar and two Gauge bosons, it appears in many anomalous dimensions, at one and also at two loops. So, okay, you see, the more you compute, the less you need to compute at the end. So, yeah, that's basically it. So, I don't know which time it is, but... So this is what I was planning to talk about. Ooh, okay. This is what I was planning to talk about these anomalous dimensions. And yeah, I was planning to say something about positivity, but as you feel, then maybe it's too late. Like
15 minutes, you started late, so...
Yeah.
Okay,
I can try to do this and go to the main to the actual. Okay, so this is a little bit different. What we are trying to do is this. We will have some effective field theory that for us will be a polynomial in the kinematical variables, and you will see that you will have some constraints. What do I mean? So we know that not all the infrared dynamics can be completed. For instance, in this paper by it's the famous example 15 years ago, these people, Adams, Nima, Dubovsky, Nicolis, and Ricardo, they showed that if you have this three-level amplitude, so it's basically a polynomial in S squared, which is the most generic three-level amplitude that you can have in the forward limit, because you have S, T, and U. U is minus S minus T, but T you are sending to zero, so it's only S. If you have this amplitude, it must be that all the coefficients of the powers of S have to be positive. If they are not positive, the UV theory is not going to be unitary. And now, unitary, okay, it will be that that the branch cut is positive. So basically, S degree S equals to 1, which implies that the imaginary part is proportional to the cross section, which is a positive thing. I will show you the argument that led these people to this thing, and I will try to show you somehow how you can extend these results. So the idea is this. First, you assume that the amplitude has a very simple branch cut structure. It's only a cut above threshold, above 4m squared, right? And the cross-symmetric part. So it's these two cuts that you have that you can see here. Then the second assumption is unitary in the sense that S degree S is equal to 1, so the imaginary part of the amplitude is related to the cross-section, which is a positive thing. And then the third assumption is polynomial boundedness, which means that the amplitude is going to 0 if you divide it by enough powers of S. And the Frossard bound, we take for granted the Frossard bound that is telling you that the amplitude divided by S squared is going to 0 when S goes to infinity. if you take these three ingredients, okay, yeah. So yeah, take these three ingredients, and now you have two regions in this plane, one close to the origin, when you have some good EFT description, and above some scale, this amplitude will, I mean, will receive contribution from the what you call UV. So you have above some scale, you have the UV completion. That is a whole thing, no? Okay, so what you do now is the following. So this slide is a bit busy, but let me guide through it. So you can use the Cauchy theorem on the amplitude, no, on the forward amplitude divided by this s to the power of 2n plus 3. So why 2n plus 3? Because now for n bigger or equal than 0, the amplitude at infinity vanishes. So now you consider the following contour integral. You have an arc at infinity that, as I said, is 0. Then you have an integral on the U-channel cut. Then you have this arc here, right? And then you have an integral over the S-channel cut. Now, the U-channel and the S-channel can be related one to each other, and it gives you this integral over the imaginary part of S, because when you bring the U-channel to the S-channel, you have a minus, and the amplitude is a complex conjugate, so you have this imaginary part. That I'm going to assume that, okay, yeah, by the optical theorem, this is the cross-section, so it's positive. On the other hand, in the infrared, I have this thing that I called the arc, that is the integral of the amplitude in this path. So yeah, in some radius S, so you integrate the amplitude like this. So you have this object that is, I'm calling the arc, has two representations. One is living in the IR, so you can really go and compute the thing, is the integral over this arc. And the other representation is lives in the UV, which is this integral. And yeah, in principle, so if you only have the EFT, this is not calculable, the UV representation. But you know one thing about it is that it is positive. And this positiveness will basically translate into constraints of the arc in the IR that you can compute. Okay? So for instance, let's go back to the amplitude I was saying before. It's just a polynomial in S, right? So when you compute this arc, so the nth arc, and remember this n is the number of subtractions that you put, I mean the order of this pole. The nth arc gives you basically the Wilson coefficient, the coefficient of S to the n. So, and since the arcs are positive, also these Wilson coefficients are positive, which is the result that they had. Okay.
Can I ask you about maybe I can wait till the end too. I don't know how far you're going to go, but the. You know, if you're a skeptic, which I'll confess to be, then. You know, the assertion that's being made is that there exists effective field theories for which which in themselves seem like they make complete sense, but which there are reasons to believe can't be extended into the UV, right? That's basically the claim that's being made, if I understand it right.
So you're saying that, yeah, so what we want to show is that, so you have some amplitude, no, all over the complex plane, you say, but you only know the shape, I mean, the form of this amplitude in the infrared, right? And for instance, the most generic thing is this polynomial on S. So what one is claiming when he's doing this exercise is to say, okay, imagine that my UV completion is unitary in the sense that this branch cut is the integral of something positive. Now, since I have a way to relate the integral over this branch cut and these coefficients of this polynomial in S, I learned that these coefficients have to be positive.
Sure, I understand that. But the thing is that the you're opened, I think, when you revert to Nima's paper, and I know that the whole swampland thing builds on this, there's basically an underlying assertion that that there can be effective field theories which make perfect sense within themselves, but which cannot be extended to the ultraviolet, right? And then
Exactly.
And this is often used as an example of that. Whereas what I actually see here is not an example of that. What I see here is if, you know, because the statement is the information, I think the example in this case that would be used as the otherwise sensible effective field theory would be one where I chose some of these signs to be negative in the effective action, right? Then that would be the claim would be that that's an effective field theory which would have looked sensible, which I would only learn was sick when I went to the ultraviolet. But I don't think that's true, because if I had chosen those signs to be wrong, there's lots of ways at the low energies I can see that there's a problem there, right? Because if I look at the propagation speed of waves around a background which is rolling, I get speeds that are going, I get superluminal evolution and that kind of thing. So all of these examples that I've seen, and correct me if I'm wrong, all the ones that I've seen, they all have the character that there's some parameters in your problem in the effective theory. And for some range of those parameters, the theory is sick, and for other ranges, it's not sick. And in the UV completions, there's a similar statement. There's more parameters, and in some range, they're sick, and some range are not sick. And if I take the low energy limit of the sick thing, I get the sick thing. And if I take the low energy limit of the not sick thing, I get the not sick thing. But there's no existent, there's no example of an infrared theory which looked like it was not sick at low energies, which then can't be completed, if you see what I mean. Because all these examples where you're finding something which is sick, you could tell it was sick in the low energy theory without having to go to this high
well, making. If in this polynomial, no, as you said, if the first term that goes like S squared is negative, as you say, you have this superluminal problem, this propagation faster than light. But imagine that it's not the first term that is negative. Is the, I don't know, S to a million has a minus epsilon in front. This doesn't... So when you look at the propagation of these Goldstones, they are inside the light cone because it's ultra irrelevant this coefficient.
So that's one, but that's that specific observable may not be the one to look at. But the assertion that you have to make is that there does not exist an observable that would see that at low energies. I don't see anybody producing any evidence for that.
Yeah, you say that maybe someone super clever could find, these people that put this background and they were saying this, some crazy background that is sensitive to the millionth coefficient.
Well, just all these examples, the effective theory is just basically it's Taylor expansions, right? And so at some level, if you're seeing something go funny in a Taylor expansion, normally what's happening is that you see it in the expansion, you see it in the full theory, and you're just looking at it in different ways. And there's almost no content in the effective theory, right? So it's hard to see how an effective theory could fail to have a completion. So I think it would be really remarkable if there was one. And so that's why it seems like it'd be great to have an example of one, but I don't see any examples being given.
No, I understand that. In this example that I told you, you're telling me, imagine that I can create some kind of Gedanken experiment when I am sensitive to this particular coefficient, because, this could be possible in principle, but I have also not seen...
But it's almost certainly going to be true, right? Because all it's really saying is you had some function. And so on the one hand, my rule is that I'm only allowed to look at the Taylor expansion of that function to some order. But you're telling me that I can go to that order because you're saying that I actually can do things that accurately. But that means there's some observable that can see that Taylor expansion is going, has a problem with it. And the real function also had that problem.
The thing is that, I don't know, up to here, I'm not really sure what is this structure of this Taylor expansion. I think that, let me go a little bit down. You will see very precisely what is the condition on this Taylor expansion to have a unitary representation or a unitary theory.
I get your point, Luke, but what I don't see, maybe there's no example, but usually the UV completion has more observables, so I wouldn't be surprised either if there's something sick in the UV completion just because it has more observables. So maybe one of those is the sick one,
That would be the interesting thing. But the thing is, you'd have to construct it in such a way that the observer, the sickness was only at high energies, and there did not. And the problem will be that the effective theory is capturing, you know, there's not a one-to-one map between effective theories and UV theories. As many UV theories are all going to the same effective theory. Right. So the assertion would have to be, for there to be content to the statement that there is a swampland, the assertion would have to be not that you can find a theory that's sick only at high energies. You'd have to say that there does not exist a theory which is sensible at high energies, which could give me this effective theory, which seems, you know, really like a long shot.
Right.
Because the utility of it is they're saying that, so the what you're supposed to do is find the effective theories that have no completion, and that's the information content at low energies.
Right.
But if it's the empty set, it's not a very useful statement, right?
Yeah,
I should say that there are certainly things that are almost certainly true, that like, the absence of global symmetries in a UV completion is very likely to be true. But the more that they seem to be true, the less information they seem to carry at low energies, because it's really easy to fake a global symmetry in the effective theory by having some accidental effective theory as a symmetry. So it's like the things that are true are almost never informative, and the things, so then if you conjecture things that are informative, they're almost certainly not true. So it's kind of, the whole thing is I don't really understand. It seems like it's built on the house of cards at some level.
Well, I think let me show you the full content of this, because I think that by now this looks it feels like you say a bit almost arbitrary, these positivity conditions. I think that at the end you will see perfectly where this things is coming from, so we can can discuss again. Because you see, by this little trick, you see that that these coefficients have to be positive, but there is more. And let me show you what is the idea. So the idea is that I put these powers of 1 over s to suppress the behavior at infinity. But you could put, more generally, you can consider a polynomial of s, not just 1 over s. And if the polynomial of s is such that the integral is still positive, you will have something like the following. So look at this equation here. So I have this polynomial. I'm integrating from s to infinity. Remember that s is the radius of this arc. So I can always expand this polynomial in s over s prime, where s prime is the integration variable, because this is always smaller than 1. So what I will have is some linear combination of these arcs, that if the polynomial is positive, this linear combination is going to be positive. So a positive polynomial, you see, is mapped into a linear inequality between the arcs. So now the question that I was asking before, that what is the space of the allowed arcs, becomes into what is the space of positive polynomials. Okay, let me give you just an example, and I will tell you the general result, but I think the example is, I cannot escape it. I think it's very informative. So imagine that this polynomial that we have here, that you have here, is just this. It's 1 minus s squared over s prime squared, right? So this thing is positive because s over s prime is smaller than 1. So this is positive in the entire range of integration. And what is this? So the first term with the 1 is basically a 0. And the second term is s squared times a 1, which this thing is positive. And now remember, a 0 is C2, is the Wilson coefficient, three-level Wilson coefficient of S squared, and A1 is the Wilson coefficient of S to the fourth. So now you discover this thing that whatever your UV theory is, when you integrate out, when you integrate it out, is going to give you a C2 that is strictly larger than C4, right? But C2 and C4 are the coefficients of S, s squared and s to the fourth. So, okay, this, this is what it is. And this is, for instance, something that kills super soft behavior. So these shitty theories that we were talking before that you build just to kill them. So people build these theories that are super soft. So the main, the main contribution starts at S to the 8, S to the 10. So you basically don't see it until you are in the at the cutoff. And this tells you that these theories cannot be to be completed in under the assumptions that I showed. Okay, let me tell you about this polynomial of 1 minus s, for obvious reasons, I'm going to call it derivative d, because it's basically the difference between two consequent arcs. And also, let me consider also this polynomial. So you put insertions of s squared over s prime squared to the end. What this basically does is to shift the arcs. So now you don't have a zero, but you have a n. So you also learn that a n plus 1 has to be bigger than zero. So the trivial coefficients have to decrease when you increase the anomalous dimensions. They are forced to do this. So another thing, imagine that I take this the polynomial I had before, 1 minus s over s prime, and now it's I squared. So this derivative operator that I was saying, you square it. Now what you get, I mean, you say you expand this, you get that a0 plus a2 over 2 is bigger than a1. So what this is telling you that an arc is always smaller than the average of its neighbors. Okay, so pictorially, so it's like a second derivative. No, you are acting with d twice. It's like, yeah, you can think of it as an operator. So pictorically, it goes like this. So this, I'm plotting the size of the arcs or the Wilson coefficients, as you want, and here I'm increasing the n of the anomalous dimensions. So you have the region where the coefficients are negative is forbidden, and C2 is arbitrary, is whatever here. Has some value. Now, because the previous constraint, any other Wilson coefficient is going to be smaller. So this region is now forbidden. And now C4 is, for instance, here. And now when you have C2 and C4, something funny happens. Is that not only you have an upper bound, but you have a lower bound on the next Wilson coefficient because exactly of this constraint. Because now, you see, if C6 was inside this triangle, you will see that A1 would be larger than the average of the neighbors. So you see that this gets actually exponentially constrained as you increase n. So you basically have no freedom after some anomalous dimensions, and the entire tower is basically fixed by those assumptions. Let me tell you now the generic result very very quickly. Change variables, and now x, you call it s over s prime squared, and now this imaginary part of so and so, you get you call it d mu, which is basically just a positive measure. And now I think you understand more, because now you understand that the arcs are just the moments of some positive distribution, right? D mu is some distribution because it's positive, and you are taking it going from 0 to 1. Before we were going between s to infinity. Now this is mapped to the integral between 1 and 0. And and the arcs are basically the moments of this distribution. So now you see the question that we're asking is basically the Hausdorff moment problem. The Hausdorff moment problem is saying, okay, I have this bunch of numbers, this sequence of moments. I have this sequence of numbers. When this sequence of numbers is going to be the moments of some positive distribution? And Hausdorff found the solution. And let me just say the result. some AN, some sequence. AN is an infinite sequence of moments if and only arbitrary number of these shift operators applied to an arbitrary number of these derivative operators on these ANs, on these arcs, are positive. So you have here many. So yeah, you have an infinite number of linear constraints on the arcs. If and only if all these linear constraints are positive, your arcs can be identified as some as moments of some positive distribution, or what is the same, as Wilson coefficients of some UV theory. So there is a very nice intuition of what these constraints mean, but you have to do a mental trick. Is a bit okay. If it's not useful for you, forget it, but it's useful for me. So this, I don't know what it is, but imagine that N is continuous, right? So now you have that the zero derivative tells you that Cn is positive, but now the first derivative tells you that Cn either, sorry, the first derivative is negative, so the function has to decrease. The second derivative is positive, so it has to be convex. The third derivative is negative, so you see, it flips sign. So, yeah, this is the content of this Hausdorff-Mohan problem. So, for example, what does it mean? For the, imagine, so I'm looking at the first three arcs, so A0, A1, A2. A0 is basically the normalization of this distribution that you have, so you don't care about, I mean, you can. I mean, it's used only to as a normalization. So you have that these constraints give you only this region of the space in the space of arcs. So it's this kind of banana or whatever. So it's so this boundary is telling you that A1 is bigger than A2. This is what I was telling you. And this parabola here is basically the condition of convexity. It gives you this nonlinear constraint at the end when you resum. Yeah, when you have some everything. If you put another arc, now you have this this shape here. So you see that these arcs have to live inside this little shape. So yeah, this might be a bit weird, but let me tell you what happens with some simple theory. So let me have a UV theory, integrate it out, and look at the arcs. Maybe give you some intuition. So if you have a single scalar, you integrate out the scalar, it's basically a propagator, so it's the geometric series. And now you have, you go to threshold, and all the arcs are equal to one. So the single scalar lives at the vertex of this thing. Now imagine you have two scalars. So let's imagine the two limiting cases, no? When the two scalars are degenerate, it's like having one scalar, because no, it's like one scalar. Now, if one of these scalars, you decouple and send it to infinity, again, you send, I mean, you decouple the scalar, so it's like having one scalar. And in the middle, something more or less interesting happens, which is this red orbit here. So, yeah, at the vertex, the scalars are degenerate, you start to increase the mass of the one, of one of them, it does like this, and when you start to completely decouple the guy, it goes to, I mean, to the single scalar case again. So three scalars is the blue region, four scalars is the green region. If now instead of a propagator you put it's a loop, what you have this single point here, and okay. So but you see, the interesting thing is that everything is inside this this shape, because of course you're integrating out something that is unitary, and yeah, so you have something that is that is a healthy EFT. And as a curiosity, you can take the Bayesian amplitude, which is a little bit more involved with these things, and you can start to see all these numeric miracles, like, yeah, for instance, the R2 minus R3 is this thing, and yeah, if you put it into Mathematica, 16 pi squared is extremely close to 168, and you get this super tiny number. And you start to get all these little things. So Okay, yeah, things that I'm going to talk about, loops, which was basically the main motivation for considering these arcs. Yeah, I will not talk about them. And also, you can go beyond forward if you put further assumptions, but okay. Yeah, that was it. So as a conclusion, it seems that, yeah, this generic principle give you, yeah, new ways to compute relevant quantities and maybe teach you something of which dynamics may or may not be completed in this specific sense. So, yeah, thank you.
Very nice, thank you.
I don't know if now it's a bit clearer, this discussion of what people mean by ubi-completing, non-ubi-completing, positivity. At the end of the day, I don't know, I like very much this picture. No, it's exactly this. You have some positive measure in the ubi, and you're basically, what you say, you're Taylor expanding this thing. And just by the fact that you started with this positive measure, your Taylor expansion is not completely arbitrary. It has to be, it's locked into some structure. And this structure is this these things here.
So that's interesting to pin that down, because it's, it would be, I think I agree with you, it would be very interesting if you could exclude that if someone hands me some random the dimension six terms of some theory, and if you could tell me that I have to restrict their coefficients to be in some range, that would actually be very interesting information. But what bothers me in the arguments is that there's a requirement. One of your slides, you pointed this out, that you really have to take the sequence to infinity to draw these conclusions. That you really can't stop anywhere because of course you can have a polynomial.
Yeah, exactly. No, this is. Yeah, this is important. This is, I removed the slides where I was in the case where I have a finite sequence of moments, because there was too much stuff. In fact, these plots are done with. You can recover them from these inequalities, but it's much more efficient to do it in some other way when you have this finite number of moments. Basically, the Hausdorff theorem considers only an infinite sequence of moments. You have to go to the proof and modify it in case you have a finite number of moments, but still, you have some space for it.
Well, for example, you said that these super soft theories are an example of a class of theories that would be ruled out, and so that would be interesting if you could really rule them out. And so one of the things I didn't quite get was because the thing is, in effective theory, you never really have the infinite number of terms, right? You always have to stop because you're usually using locality, and locality is only true at some fixed order in the inverse mass expansion.
Yeah.
So is there? And so I'm to the extent that, I guess the first question is there a statement if I only have a finite number of terms? And I think you just said that there is. And then the second thing is that statement relying on a radius of convergence in the energy expansion having a minimum size of some sense? So, because all the examples I've seen before, in the end of the day, it comes down to a statement that if I have any theory I want, I can have it. But I'm making statements about what would have to be happening at very high energies for that to be consistently UV completed. But statements which can't be ruled out. It might be true that there is something that does that. There's content in that, but it's not the same thing as saying that I can't extend things.
Yeah, exactly. I'm forgetting by the moment. The first thing you were saying is that if it's possible that with a finite number of terms to put some constraints.
Yes.
Actually, you can translate this into this mathematical problem. Is instead of considering this infinite sequence of moments, I'm giving you these three numbers. Can they be the first three elements of of a sequence of moments of some distribution. No, it's a mathematical, just close mathematical question, and the answer is yes. And the answer is this region here.
But did that assume that in making that argument, are you assuming that the series I've got is converging, say, as opposed to being asked about it?
Exactly, and this is. Another point, because the way we constructed these things, before what people were doing, people were not having, they didn't have this this arc here, so they didn't have an escape. They had, just the residue at zero. And when you have the residue at zero, this... So you don't have the house of moment problem. You have another moment problem that is the Stieltjes moment problem. And the Stieltjes moment problem is the same question as the house of, but now the limits of integration don't go from zero to one, but they go from zero to infinity. Because now the integration basically goes from zero to infinity. So you lose this kind of infrared scale that is this S, that is some finite value of the energy where you try to measure your theory. And this is, it's not a tiny change. This is a conceptual difference between one problem and the other. Because when the integral is from zero to infinity, do not have a solution. So there is no test that you can do to a bunch of numbers to tell you if they are the distribution the moments of a Stieltjes distribution. So from zero to one, there is a closed and solved answer, and this is the Hausdorff this Hausdorff theorem. But from zero to infinity it's proven that the solution, it's not solvable. It's a problem that doesn't have a solution. It's not unique. So let me say it this way. It's not unique, the distribution.
So, so I wasn't sure what the answer was there. Is there an assumption being made about convergence of the series, or is it something which is, if I allowed myself to think of the low energy expansion being asymptotic, and I'm not sure if I should be able to allow myself that, but if I did allow myself that, do I avoid all these theorems?
What do you mean by?
Well, asymptotic would mean it's like the electromagnetic expansion in QED. It's there's no the radius of the convergence is strictly speaking zero.
You're assuming that the only singularities are in which determines the convergence are in the branch cut and are in the branch cut.
Yeah.
So the only structure that you have is basically polynomials and logs. So maybe this is connecting with the problem we're having now in some different. So here we are using we are putting constraints in a Goldstone theory. So you start the theory is infrared finite, basically. If you put lambda phi 4 is not IR finite. You have 1/T divergences. You have splitting of solved divergences, and you start to have things like this. So in 5^4, these things are not valid. Exactly. The cross section is not well defined. You don't have a single scale problem because you have all these divergences. But in the Goldstone theory, the cross section is finite since everything is soft. Everything is finite, and you don't have any issues. But you have to assume this you don't have any IR divergence and this thing. So this is a hidden assumption. I don't know if it goes in the direction that you were saying that maybe, I mean, how to, I mean, what are really the assumptions that go into here, no? So, yeah, infrared finiteness is one of them.
And so if I tried to, I'm trying to think of, I don't know anything about super soft theories. I'm trying to think of most concrete example of something that's ruled out. So in that Goldstone example, it sounds like super soft would be like saying that the first few terms in the effect of Lagrangian are zero.
Exactly.
They're kind of just on the edge of what would be allowed or not allowed. And so, so what's the statement? Is if I had the first one be zero, but the second one have a specific sign, is that sick, or is that what's the simplest thing you can rule out?
Yeah, some people have tried to design these super soft theories that they are basically an extension of the Goldstone. No, the Goldstone, you have this shift symmetry, so the only thing you can have is d pi as a term in the Lagrangian. So you can have some kind of a Galilean symmetry. So yeah, the Galilean is basically this. The Galilean you are not ruling out, but you can extend the Galilean. The Galilean is that the shift symmetry depends on the coordinates, depends on x. So d phi is not invariant, but d to some power phi, this would be invariant. So the first term you allow, the first term you allow to write down in your Lagrangian maybe is d d pi to the fourth. This will give you an amplitude that goes like s to the fourth, but give you no powers of, so s squared is zero. So it will start with s to the fourth. So what this thing is telling you is that you cannot find a unitary theory that you can integrate out and give you something that starts at this order.
Subject to the assumptions that you made,
If you
violate the bound and all those things,
if you violate the Frossard bound, you shift this conclusion to higher terms. But if
I see. Okay.
So let's thank Mark again.
Sorry, it took forever, but